Welcome back to Around the Prompt. This is Logan Kilpatrick. Today we're joined by Andrew Main. Andrew is an incredible person. You're going to love this conversation. We talk about his journey to OpenAI, how AI literally saved his life from a great white shark, whether or not we've hit a wall with GPT-4, and more. Sweet, Andrew. Thank you for being here. I wrote this down and I think it is like a actual fact of the world, which is you have one of the most non-traditional AI backgrounds that I've ever seen. And I'm really, really curious actually if you could take us back. I don't know if it was specifically OpenAI or before OpenAI or what the journey to get started in AI looked like for you.
So I've had an intermittent kind of experience in AI going back to when I was a kid. And I used to, you know, excited about robotics and AI. And as a kid, I would write little basic programs, little chat bots. And, you know, I always hated the chat bots at the time because they were stateless and you could tell that I liked a movie and it would forget it. And so I would like try to figure out how to set little variables to remember things like you said, you like the color blue in this because that was part of, you know, what seemed important to me. And of course, you know, as you get older, you realized like I was like Weizenbaum's, you know, doctor script for Eliza where it could like just keep asking you questions and people would be engaged by that. And so people have different ways of evaluating. So I was very into robotics when I was a kid in AI. I would build stuff. I would take apart everything I could, like a bicycle brake, you know, and use that as a hand gripper for a robot, PVC pipe, whatever I could do to just build stuff. And then I got interested in magic. And so that kind of like took me away from the world of physics and robotics into performing and ended up performing around the world as a magician and illusionist. I had a big stage show. I'd, you know, make a woman levitate and saw people in half and do that. But I kept coming back into the sciences and got involved in critical thinking, working with a program to help promote critical thinking. And through there, I got to meet neat people. I met Marvin Minsky, you know, I was like 20. And, you know, Marvin, one of the pioneers, and got to ask him all kinds of questions, was on a message surf with him. And, you know, he would pose these puzzles that would be like way above my head. But it was just neat to be able to ask him stuff about consciousness, stuff like this. You know, Roger Penrose would say something and ask Marvin what he thought about that. So I just kept kind of involved in that. But, you know, I didn't really know what kind of place there was going to be for me in AI until years later. I did a television series for A&E called Don't Trust Andrew Main. And then I was getting out of TV and starting to get into tech and, you know, just said I need to kind of go back and just relearn because I hadn't like. Last thing I programmed was like, you know, basic or maybe some HTML, but I really need to learn a language. So I started learning and started building projects, started going through that and building up my skills. And then I was talking to my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. And she asked me like, are you done with TV? I'm like, well, yeah, I'm ready to kind of just go into technology. And I said, you know, there was this one thing that I kind of wanted to do. Cause like I had my own TV series, which was cool. I'd, you know, being able to travel around the world was nice. But then I said, you know, I just wanted to try to fool a great white shark because why not? And I had spoken to Discovery Channel off and on, you know, about TV projects before. And, you know, when I was younger, like, ah, oh, you're too young and then whatnot. And then I said, you know, I have this idea of how to use what I know about magic and technology to try to deceive a great white shark, which is probably stupid, but it'd be fun to do. By chance, I mentioned that to somebody and they knew. A former Discovery Channel producer, now at his own production company, a guy named Mike Sorensen, reached out to him, said, hey, I have this idea. He said, that's cool. Let's hop on a call with the head of Shark Week. So like literally a week later, we're on a phone call with the head of Shark Week, and I explained the idea to him. And I said, this is how I think I could fool a great white shark. It's mixtures, magic technology and this. And he's like, oh, that sounds awesome. Are you stupid enough to do it? Not quite that phrasing, but basically I'm like, yes, I am that stupid. And so the premise would be I would go into the water with great white sharks and try to make myself invisible, not get eaten. And I had a couple ideas on how I was going to do this, but I needed to do, you know, a bunch of research. And part of this involved talking to shark scientists and part of this involved the technology aspect. And one of the things I wanted to do as part of that was to give myself the ability to see 360 degrees underwater. Because the thing about great white sharks is they're what you call ambush hunters. They wait for you to not be looking their way. And they can see where you're looking. We think of them just like dumb fish, but they're not. They're very sensitive about certain things. So if you're not looking, then they'll come up behind you. And so I thought, well, having a 360 degree camera that could warn me when a shark was coming near would be useful. So I took a 360 degree camera and then, you know, unfolded the image and I said, okay, how do you detect sharks? And so I found an online tutorial on, you know, how to build your own image detector. and started learning about OpenCV, started learning about these things and trying to figure out that out. And it was funny too, because like, I didn't know a lot of terminology. I look at it and I'm like, I only got like a couple hundred images of great white sharks. I'm like, well, this isn't enough images. I said, well, what if I take like a 3D engine image and a really good image of a video model of a shark, and I take thousands of screenshots of it from different angles and then change the cloudiness and all that. Synthetic data. I didn't know what that was at the time, but I was able to generate just a ton of really good data along with my, you know, actual shark photos. I built a really good shark detector. While working on this, I'm studying, you know, how do image algorithms work, image detection systems work, and, you know, you find out about HAAR-like features, you know, edge detection. And I was having a conversation with a shark scientist, and they said, yeah, you know, sharks see things differently. So, you know, if you're in a cage, they don't see you, they see the outline of the cage. And I'm like, huh, that's makes sense. Because if you think about it, sharks are known for having an incredible sense of smell. Incredible, like great whites have like, you know, better vision than we do, probably better at night vision than we do. They have incredible sense of sound. They have like the Lorenzus lines, which allow them to sense electrical fields. You know, their teeth are a sense organ. That's why they bite you, is to see if you're edible or not. Unfortunately, if you're not edible and you die, doesn't faze them. But they also have very small brains. You know, sharks have been around for hundreds of millions of years, longer than, you know, trees, basically, which means that their brains have basically become very efficient, but very small, which means they have to have all kinds of algorithms for what they need to pay attention to and what they don't. And so I thought about this, and I came to the conclusion that what I probably want to do is camouflage myself in such a way, not as I have to be sophisticated. My first version of the suit that I was building a suit for camouflaging myself. It was kind of like the Predator thing. I had these LEDs all around me and cameras. And so my front matched the back and whatever. And it looked really cool if like I stood like in a backyard or something like that. Moment you put it into salt water, moment you put it in there, one, there was a buoyancy issue. And like I did it, the TV special, you can see me floating. I'm like an idiot on the top of the ocean. Not a lot of time to test these things before you put them out there. But I knew really what I just need to do is to match my front and my back and like my silhouette, get rid of it, basically just sort of blend in as much as I can. So I built a second generation suit, which was basically just focused on that. Went into the water with the great whites first without the suit. They wanted to come up. They bumped into me. I had to use my shield to bounce them away. We were at a place called Isle of Jaws, which is a bunch of great whites go there to feed. Like there are hundreds and hundreds of great whites in that area. So you just everywhere you look at great white and they just come up to inspect you. Second dive, put on the suit, turned it on, they stayed away. And it was a very interesting sort of intersection between kind of like image systems, AI, biology, et cetera. And that got me just down this path of AI because I realized, oh, wow, it's such a frontier area. There's so many different directions you can go. As a writer, I write 2 books a year, I write mystery thrillers. And that always has been like, you know, when will AI write books? I was a thing, you know, I love to write. I don't want the AI to write the book for me, but I always, you know, wondered like at what time frame does that, you know, work against me? So I would play with like little simple models that were doing, you know, next character predictions, maybe next word predictions. I don't even think I really was aware of GPT-1 when it came out. But when GPT-2 came out, that was big because that was the first time you saw a text model that could just produce coherent stuff for more than a few sentences. And I got obsessed. So OpenAI had published everything that GPT-2, they put an entire GitHub repo filled with GPT-2 outputs. And so I read every single one of those. I hadn't even read the paper yet. And I was trying to figure out what's going on. And you could see how it could pay attention at the top. And you would see how it's sort of like, pay more attention to things that said before and then kind of lose coherence. And then when you start to look at attention mechanisms and how the transformers are working, you go, oh, wow, you can actually see this when you read the text. And that was sort of this fascinating kind of like the shark thing in this. You see that sort of parallel between one system or an output and another. So became very interested in how text models worked. And it was quite kind of random somebody who worked at OpenAI listened to a podcast that I do and had somebody reach out to me, and I got contacted by a woman named Ashley Thilson, whose name I can never pronounce right. Sorry, Ashley. And they said, hey, can we put you under an NDA? We're OpenAI. We want to show you something. I'm like, yeah, of course. What could go wrong with a super secret nefarious organization asking me to be under NDA to show me something middle of the pandemic, you know? So I said, yeah. And they said, hey, we have it. She goes, have you ever heard of GPT-2? I'm like, yes. Like, I am the biggest GPT-2 fanboy. Well, we have GPT-3. Do you want to play with it? I said, absolutely. And so I just went nuts, nonstop, day and night. I would literally be up so late, like, you know, almost, you know, at the keyboard, we're almost comatose, just trying different things, experimenting with us, and then sending these things to OpenAI. I say, you know, you can do this. I realized when it made this mistake here, if I asked it further about this, I could get it to go then. I could now get a prompted to do that. And I ended up writing a big part of the prompt library for that and the documentation, just started creating the stuff for OpenAI because it was a very small team. You know, they didn't have enough time for somebody to go play with it. So I just kept playing with it and working on it and finding all these capabilities for it. At the time, I was planning on launching my own company. I built an app called AI Channels, which you can still see at aichannels.app, which had basically, it's funny because it's like, I think I was telling Logan about this before. It's like everything you have now in, like, you know, a Copilot or, you know, Gemini or, you know, ChatGPT was in there, but not because it was, because all of it was obvious. All the stuff that you would do if you thought, and these things have been around for years. You know, we've had chat apps since 1960s. 1978, there was an app called Cyrus, which was basically imitating the Secretary of State that would use UPI press wires for real-time news information. So you can see throughout history. And so GPT-3 is the first time you could kind of just throw that all into a language model. But I built an app that had, there wasn't a term for RAG at that point, but I was using a form of semantic search to do context injection to make it, you know, be able to have context. I had infinite, you know, conversation threads because I would truncate whatever. And I'm like, cool, I would love to go create this and go build this. And then I was waiting to find out what token costs were going to be. And this is 2020, right? So 2020 was one, it was 4 years ago this week. And then I find out token costs for GPT-3 DaVinci were going to be 6 cents per 1,000 tokens. And for a consideration of that, I think a million tokens on what Flash, Gemini Flash is like what, 15 cents, 30 cents? Ridiculously 30. Just, yeah, 30 cents in ridiculously order of magnitude difference now when it comes to your token costs. But at the time, so I didn't want to put out an app that was going to be like, hey, I got to charge $40, you know, a month for this. I wanted something that had as like as generous of a free tier to let people use it as it could be. I said, nah, I don't think I'm going to go do this. I think it's, for me, I thought like it's too early for what I wanted to do with it. So I joked to OpenAI, I'm like, yeah, if you want the world's oldest intern, let me know. Like, we'd love to have you. And then went to work there. My original title was Creative Applications, was their first prompt engineer, and worked there doing a lot of different things. When it's a small company, you end up wearing a lot of hats, which I loved. And, you know, could go work on model capabilities, could go build prototypes for, you know, GPT stores, things like this. I would put it onto, had built apps running on device, you know, showing what it could do. And then as it grew a bit and realized that the gap between what people understood about these systems and what they could do was kind of wide, and they brought on board a really amazing comms team. And I asked, can I go work with these people for a while? And what turned into a few months turned into 2 years. And I was the science communicator for OpenAI up until September last year, when I decided to actually, maybe now's the time to go build, because, you know, we're at this wonderful point where we're incredible efficiencies. So there you have it.
I would say that is the crazy story. And even when I was doing my research, I knew it was a crazy story, but that is, yeah, quite a lot of turns and changes of pace, but that's phenomenal. I guess an immediate question I'm very curious about too is, like, when you were first approached by OpenAI to kind of, you know, play around with ChatGPT-3, you know, obviously you said you're up night and day. What kind of prompts or what were you actually putting into the model and trying to, like, you know, probe it to get out as far as outputs go? I'm just curious if there was a specific domain you were trying to tackle or just kind of any and everything.
So, Nolan, a thing to think about, most people's experience now with models are instruct models. You know, their models instruct, their message formatted models. So most people think of an AI as something that's already been conditioned to understand that it is an AI and that's what it's trying to do. If you go back and look at DaVinci, right, in the DaVinci, when that first came out, there was a DaVinci instruct, but the very first version of DaVinci, the first, you know, the big GPT-3 model, this had been trained on a huge corpus of text. And in order to get it to do something, what a prompt meant something, a prompt literally was, you know, if I wanted to write an essay on, you know, Mars, I wouldn't say write an essay on Mars because it might go, no. Because it could just think that, oh, am I emulating a Reddit forum? You know, and what role am I doing here? Because the model didn't have the training. It was just trying to predict that. And so sometimes in the world of text, somebody might say, do a thing for me. And somebody could say, no, don't do that. So you had to figure out how do you lead it. So a lot of it was figuring out like, okay, how do I use the fewest amount of tokens to get it to do what I want it to do? And so I'd say, okay, Wikipedia topic Mars, Mars is. And then it would go, okay, it thinks it's writing a Wikipedia article. And then it would write, you know, what you needed to know about Mars. And so that was a lot of prompting, was saying, how do you get this base model to do a thing that it that basically get it a thing that it should know how to do, but frame it. And you would see a lot of mistakes early, you know, even, you know, people from AI were making who weren't familiar with deep learning or how these language models work. People I respected be like, I asked to do this and it gave me a wrong answer. It's like, yeah, because it's not chat. It's not a chat model. It's literally a predictive text model. And it, you can say it could, it would fail a simple test. But if you put at the top, you know, this is a test. Some of these questions may be trick questions. You watch the model perform much better because it was in the headspace of, oh, okay, I think I'm trying to give the right answers. Or answer key. If you use, this is the answer key for a physics test, you get better things. So I would find things out there like answer key or things like this, real simple. You know, I like to do like zero shot prompts or just get to as few of examples as I could by trying to understand what the model would do. And an example would be, I was asked because, you know, somebody was trying to figure out how to get one of the smaller models to classify companies, like tell me like what category is Google, what category is Microsoft, et cetera. And it would kind of go off the rails a little bit. You know, newer models don't have that problem. But back then, you know, DaVinci might do that. And so what I had to do would say, okay, well, I'm going to give it, I'm going to say, you know, here's Google's description, here's Microsoft. Explain these different companies. It would say, okay, Google, industry, technology. And it kept using like the word industry or sector. It would use the word sector. I said, oh, instead of asking for category, ask for sector. You let the model tell you what to do. And a lot of it was just stuff like that, like figuring out like what are the keywords to do. Smaller models. If you asked a small model, what's the airport code for Orlando? It'd want to use ORL, the abbreviation for Orlando, when it's actually MCO. But if you showed it a few examples of airport codes that were different than the city abbreviations, all of a sudden the smaller model could now get you that. And so you could use a way more efficient model to do a problem. So it was just deep dive into that. And then as we got the instruct models, those models, there was a point where they were kind of frustrating because they got really dumb for me, but then they got a bit better. And then what you have now is you're at the level of prompting would be, you know, you'd come out with, you know, we had GPT-4. I'm in the paper for capabilities discovery and figuring out what can it do. And people would go, you know, internally to OpenAI, like, we don't know if it can do Wordle. I'm like, I think it can do Wordle. I think it's just a tokenization problem. And the problem is that, you know, if it sees some words might be one, you know, one token, you know, others might be multiple. But if you figure out how to break it down into that, and so like, you know, I internally published and then externally published, like, no, actually it can do Wordle, it can do these things. So that's what prompt engineering to me kind of went from, how do you get a base model to do a thing that it should be able to do in the minimal, most, you know, the fewest amount of tokens, to how do you get to do these models to do things that they should be able to do, but don't seem always obvious.
Andrew, I was just sitting with my girlfriend this past weekend, and she was doing Wordle and trying to get me to help. And I was like, I cannot be bothered to do this. And I took a picture. Neither of the two technologies that I tried were able to give me any useful advice. And then I was scrolling through your blog, and I had saw that you had put out the blog post about how to get the models to actually do well at Wordle.
And that's a great example, though, of a thing a model can do and should do easily, but it doesn't do because you go, oh, there's signal there. We know that to get probably even a GPT 3.5 or, you know, a Gemini 1 to get that up to speed to be able to do that, like, you know, if we're, you know, fine tuning for Flash is happening, you probably find that like, oh, I could probably give it enough examples of breaking this thing down. It'll learn it. You don't need an entirely new architecture to do it. You just have to show the model how to generalize from one thing to the other to do it.
I'm interested in whether or not you, like, what your perspective is on how dominant chat as like the interface and also like the way that the models are trained, how you feel about Brawley as somebody who was able to sort of experiment deeply with the models in sort of the early days and seeing now how dominant chat is. Do you think the models have, I've seen this thread come up a few times where people feel like the models have lost some ability, or, you know, some of the ability is sort of RLHF'd out of the capabilities of the model. Do you feel that same way when you're trying to build with the technology today, sort of as a practitioner?
I certainly think that when you optimize towards one thing, you often lose the capability of something you don't, particularly if you're trying to make it more efficient. I've seen this with models that were capable of a feature like, let's say, doing really precise word count. An early version of it could do a word count really well, give me 200 words, 150 words. And then as it was fine-tuned for other things, all of a sudden that feature degraded. And a lot of that, yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to is, if in the new sets of training, if you're not training for those things, and that's why one of the hardest things to do really when you have an AI company is to understand what your users are using it for. You know, we have leaderboards. We have like now two leaderboards for it. I think there's an opportunity for another leaderboard, which is to be into more like expert user leaderboards. Because right now we look at a leaderboard and we see what's ELO for like everybody. But the way I use something, you know, if somebody goes in and asks a thing once and gets a response, that's great. With a multi-turn conversation, it might be different. You might see degradation. That's one of the problems we had originally was when the first, you know, using kind of like a 3.5 level model, some of the earlier models, is that after your conversation gets beyond a certain point, you know, it can go off the rails because there just wasn't a lot of training on that. They're training with a few examples, et cetera. So I certainly do think that anytime you try to optimize the model, optimization means deciding what's important and what's not. And if you're not fundamentally increasing the capability there, you run the risk of that. I complain less. When the first Instruct models came out, like I complained a lot because I just couldn't get them to do things. And it wanted extremely short answers to this. Models are still really bad at writing in that they want to summarize, you know, not actually write. These things can improve. They'll get better over time. But to your point, like, yeah, I do think that when you try to optimize or distill a model down, you're going to lose the things that aren't in the evals when you're trying to see if that was a successful optimization.
Why do you think the models are so bad at writing? I feel like this is a universal truth. When I was in between OpenAI and Google, me and Nolan had actually talked about, should we make a company to help people with AI writing? Because it seems like the models are just like not capable of doing this.
So you can get them to write better. I've got, you know, stuff that I've built with my wife who's working on a startup for creatives and whatnot that you do have to work around what they want to do. The reason they, in my opinion, Anthropic models tend to have the reputation for being better at writing. And part of that has to do with just what you consider how you value output. Part of it can just be purely content alone. You know, how are you evaluating it? If you pay a bunch of data labelers to look at something and they're just looking for keywords to say, yes, it got it, then you're going to optimize what your data labelers are. If you have a bunch of people who are really good at evaluating what's a well thought out essay, et cetera, whatever, then you're going to optimize around that. So that comes from right there. Their models can only get as good as you tell them. This is what is good and what's not. Another thing happens is that, you know, we get these conversations coming out like, oh, we're running out of data. We're going to run out of data. And the problem is like that assumes that GPT-3, GPT-4, GPT-2, Gemini would all have turned out exactly the same if you just gave it the same amount of data, when we know that's not true. You know, you take Common Crawl, you know, Common Crawl has all this different internet data, et cetera. A small model can only pay attention to a few things. So if I give it a long form 4,000 word essay, ain't going to matter. It's only going to be able to understand a paragraph at a time, and it's not going to understand the relationship of one paragraph to another or chapters within chapters. And that's, we're not there yet. That's one of the things that's interesting is you look at, we've been pushing the boundaries of long context inputs, but not long context outputs. Like what's the max output right now? Like maybe 8,000 words in some models. And that tells you that we're really, even though they can do 8,000 token outputs, probably the evals are looking at much shorter examples of that. So there's not a lot of evals coming out where people are looking at really, really long form content to sort of say, oh yeah, this is doing a really good job. Because it's tricky, but there are ways around it.
Yeah. And just as a quick follow-up, why do you think that is? Because actually, like inherently for, and again, this obviously is not the way that all decisions are made, but from a business perspective, actually most model providers make most of their money on output tokens. It's like output tokens are like much more expensive. I guess maybe they don't make most of their money on output tokens because proportionally there's a lot more input tokens than output tokens, but like, why do you think the incentive is for people who are building models to not have them? Is it just like exponentially more expensive? I don't have a good intuition.
It's harder to measure. So if I have a model spitting out 10,000 word essays, and I'm going to use humans to evaluate that, how many per day can I get evaluations on? You know, like it's hard, and we'll get there. Cause like, you know, eventually you could take everything in Project Gutenberg and probably train a really good model if you have the resources. And as we see, these models are now better at evaluation stuff. And there are steps that you can do in between. Cause part of the problem is that we're getting now into I think the Microsoft 5.3 models are interesting because they used a lot of synthetic data. They started with smaller vocabularies and went to larger vocabularies. And I think that we're going to see too, like another big thing that's going to happen, and we're seeing this now with special tokens. We're going to see people say, okay, and with this, you get this too with multi-turn, by the way. When you do chat conversations, because it used to be, well, here, write a 500 word essay on this. Here's my essay. Well, what you want is, I need to write an essay on Mars. Give me 10 bullet points about Mars. Give me, you know, explain the moral applications of colonizing this. Let me get these things and iterate till you get to that 500 word essay. So I think you're going to get a lot more data like that, where instead of just going, here's my one line input. And I hate demos, by the way, where people say like, generate your company PowerPoint presentation with one line. Well, cool. That's for an imaginary company. There's no facts or data in there about my company whatsoever. And you see a lot of that the one line email to a hypothetical person that doesn't exist. You need to have more context in there. So on one hand, it sounds magical and amazing. And you're like, well, you know, it's like, hey, it wrote a whole letter, a Christmas letter to my family describing things that don't exist, you know, so context matters. But we're getting now with messages, you can now say the iterative process. As a writer, I start off with a premise. You know, what if a scientist hunted serial killers? Okay, what kind of science would be cool? Oh, computational biology. And then I'd say, okay, what would be a really good challenge? And I go iterate back and forth until I get to the point of idea, you know, mission statement, you know, cool thoughts to have in it, to summary, to outline, to novel. And when you have all those steps that you could then train models on, then you're going to see a really big improvement. Because it will be able to reason through those steps. Right now, we're asking them to reason from a small thing to a much bigger thing. And that's not even how we do it.
Andrew, I'd love to get your perspective on, you know, I think there's prompt engineering thrown out there quite a lot, right? You know, being able to talk to these large language models. And I think that there's, you know, semi a debate where you need to be very technical in order to be a good prompt engineer compared to some individuals or more so, you know, it's a large language model, talk to it like a human. You don't have to get technical or really strategic. It sounds like you take the more strategic approach which entails, you know, being more careful with the words you're using, you know, learning from the words that you use that are giving you the better outputs. So I guess, you know, for folks who are starting with, you know, any large language model, trying to get outputs that they want, how important is it for them to make sure that they're using the right language rather than just potentially talking to it like another human? I guess you're kind of your thoughts on that debate as a whole.
Yeah, to me, years ago, I worked for a man named James Randi, who had a $1 million prize to anybody who could prove psychic powers were real, right? It's called the $1 million paranormal challenge. And as of yet, unclaimed. And I would go into laboratories where they'd say, we found somebody who can like read with their fingertips, or we have this rod that picks up quantum rays and can detect things. BS. And I'm open. I want to believe in this stuff. That's why I got into it. And you realized how we're fooled, right? And one of the ways it's important for scientists when they're testing something that maybe they want to believe in whatever is we talk about how science can be blinded. You do a study where you don't know what the participants are, you know, they don't know what drug they're taking. Double blinded would be you don't know who was taking which thing, so that way you can evaluate it. A lot of the problem when you're trying to create prompts, you're trying to do this stuff, is we can be very guilty of thinking, I got a couple of things that work right. This must be the right path. And that leads to people writing really convoluted, you are the smartest person in the world. I'm going to ask you these questions and you have a 240 IQ, these really, really lengthy things that you see a lot of prompt engineers go out there and put, and they never evaluate it. They don't measure it to see, did that really work? Was that effective and whatnot? Each model can be different. And a model could be, you know, get an update where it had a bunch of RLHF data where all of a sudden, maybe that works better. But a lot of it is just people kind of intuiting it without really evaluating it. And so I would build tools when I was at OpenAI. I'd build like, you know, things to compare prompts, run them and see what actually worked or what didn't. I would keep, you know, keep notebooks, journals, things like this to measure the outputs. Because part of it was, I was in an environment where if I was going to go tell my peers who were all way smarter than me and PhDs and super bright people, hey, I found a thing that worked, I didn't want to look like an idiot. I didn't want them to look at like, and so I wouldn't do it once or twice. I would do a thing 20 times and compare it, you know, put it into a spreadsheet just to make sure. So I think that's part of the problem, is a lot of what's out there is sort of anecdotal. And we're seeing, I think there was just a paper, Ethan Mullick, I don't know if you follow him, but he's really following. He just, you know, repeated a paper out there that was a really good paper talking about how some of what people try to do, like the over-instructing the models, is just not helpful. For me, it would be a combination of, I would get an intuition. You know, I'm a big believer in the concept of theory of mind, of like we develop an idea of what goes on in somebody else's head. Sometimes very poorly, we don't really think a lot how other people think. And these models aren't human. They're not, they're, you know, simulacrums in some ways of this, but other ways they're bizarre. But I would try to understand what would the model see. And I can give you an example. Was I got asked, because some company was looking to use the model for working on contracts and looking at like how it could parse clauses. And they had an example, and this was like Da Vinci. It was getting 70% correct, like 70 or 80%, well above chance, but it was getting it wrong 30% of the time. And it was baffling everybody. And I went and I looked at this, I reworked the prompt, kept getting the prompt, didn't see much of an improvement. And I'm like, what's going on here? And then I went and I read the example text, and it was missing a parenthesis at one end. And so basically it had an open quote that, or had an open clause that bled into another one. Entire court cases have been fought over that. And so the model was actually right in the sense that maybe 70% of the time we would have decided it one way, 30% the other way. You put that back in there, it was 100%. And a smarter model would know, hey, you're missing a quote here. I can't really tell you this, but a less model just has to do what it can do. So I think when it comes to trying to figure out like, how do you, I'm very much a believer in like an empirical sort of prompting, and basically, how do I measure that it worked before? What do I measure it now? You go on your gut instinct and you say, like I said, just explore. When it gets, I learned so much by when it made mistakes, when it didn't do what I wanted to do. I go, why? Okay, why did it think this is a Wikipedia article? Why did it do this? Or, and then you know, oh, well, that's where it wants to go. So let me lean into that.
Andrew, I've got a pitch, a comment, and a question. One, I very much appreciate your thoughtfulness about prompting. And I feel like because of how widespread prompting has become, it's like people just like don't, it's like you don't think about it. Like you almost just like you prompt and you just never like take a step back and are like deeply thoughtful about it. And I think this rolls into my pitch to you, which is you need to get a show where you sort of break down the prompts. And like, I don't know what it is, but like I could see a TV show in the future of like how people interact with AI. And I'm hopeful that the Discovery Channel people are watching this, because I feel like we need to get you back on Discovery Channel for this specific show.
Well, you know, what's interesting is when I was at OpenAI, when I was the prompt whisperer internally, when they had the new instruct models or something came by, and somebody very high up there said to me, says, well, what are you going to do now that we don't need prompting anymore? I said, my job is to understand how to get these things to do that you didn't know what they could do. And, you know, the day that we know exactly what the models can do before they're, you know, is awesome. But I think we're further away from that than we realize. And, but it was that thing. Cause I think that was, you know, that was that understanding of like, it's like to their point though, it's like, you want to get better at that. Like what counted for prompting back then is different to an extent though. It's like, I love nothing better than when somebody says it can't, internally, I would be there if somebody says we can't do this, it can't do this. And I'm like, show me, let me see what it can do. Cause like, I have that, like that crazy sort of energy where I just want it. And sometimes they'll go, can it do this? I'd be like, no. And it won't. But I think that that's, you know, it's going to be interesting to see where these things evolve toward, because eventually these models will get smarter than me. And so I'm not going to be able to figure out a thing that it can. We're already seeing that with AIs writing prompts and stuff. So, but I do think you do get into the problem, like the tokenization problem, where it probably would be hard for a present model to understand like rhyming. People go, oh, it can't rhyme. No, it can rhyme. You just have to explain to it differently because it's trying to look at tokens and stuff. So I don't know. Hopefully we'll all become, you know, like we're all prompt engineers now.
I would say, I guess follow-up question on that as well. So with your trial and error, I guess for our viewers, is there like, you know, one or two tips you think would be helpful for individuals who are trying to get the best outputs?
One is have a very clear idea what kind of output you're looking for, right? And this is going to get back to like kind of old advice, 4-year-old advice, is one is, if you were talking to a reasonably smart person and you had to give them instructions, what would you tell them to do? Okay. If I wanted somebody to write me a 5-paragraph essay and I was talking to a student who had never heard of this, didn't understand this, whatever, I wouldn't just say, well, it's 5 paragraphs about a thing. I'd be like, okay, well, you know, take an idea. I want you to expand it into, you know, the points for it, points against it, you know, introduce the idea, do a conclusion, do these. Think about how many steps you would walk through somebody to teach them how to do a thing. And then you start taking away steps until you can start with a lot of explanations and then take things away until the model, you know, you find out the minimal amount of steps to doing that. So that's part of it. It's just the idea of saying, how would you explain it? I do a lot of like in my prompting, and it may not be the most, I do a lot of step one, step two, like even I'm using cursor to code. Even when I do that, I'm like, number one, I need you to do this. And part of what helped me, and this is like kind of a little origin story, was back when I used to do magic, I started creating magic tricks for magicians. And I'd come up with an idea like, you know, a cool trick with dollar bills or whatever. And then I would make videos and I would teach them. And I had to figure out, how do I communicate to somebody who might be an expert or may just be beginning in magic? How do I communicate to them how to learn something? So I figured out, like, how do you assume the minimal number of steps you need to teach something? And how do you do that? And that helped me a lot when I learned with these models, because I could just take the same thing as I've kind of got to teach it how to do a thing. And so that's it. Look at like how you explain to somebody too, is if it can't do a thing, try to break down where it was. Like Wordle was an example of, these models were smart enough to understand the rules of Wordle, but it was struggling at Wordle. But you had to flip it around and say, what is the model seeing? You know, the model wasn't seeing those words. The model was seeing the tokens, the numerical values for those things. And an example I do when I lecture is I show like, here's the word apple. And I show apple with a lowercase and it looks completely different. And you find out that a number of words are different because it's uppercase, lowercase, whatever. And we don't think of that in our embedding space. It's just there. Now, in its embedding space, it's pretty close, but that can make all the difference in the world. So just understand, how is it actually seeing this? What is it sort of understanding? And then work backwards.
Andrew, do you take credit for the creation of prompt engineering as a discipline? And how do you feel about like the direction that it's gone? Because I feel like the advice that you give is like so thoughtful and like and grounded. And I feel there's been, I don't know what the right word is to describe what's happened to prompt engineering, but it's like very gross now. It's like, it's almost like a bad joke.
So no, when I came to OpenAI, they already had prompts and examples for GPT-3, the researchers to come up with. So that was the thing that it was, but it was researchers were doing it and having somebody who sort of spent kind of, you know, all day kind of doing that. Well, I mean, a researcher might do. So I literally was just the right sort of, you know, insane manic energy when it came to this at the right time with the right company to kind of be a guy, who had a really strong language background and liked AI to go in there and help with that. I know that there are people at OpenAI today that I helped, you know, sort of show them stuff too, but they showed me stuff too. I learned a lot from other people. So, you know, it's a very collaborative sort of space. I would say that what's interesting is that you had waves. So there was early 2020 prompting, like people who were doing prompting in 2020. And then when kind of like the ChatGPT era came about or the instruction models came about, then you kind of had a new wave and a lot of rediscovery. And so it was funny. It was being frustrated. It was funny because you would see an academic paper come out and people like, oh, look at this new method. And you're like I wrote that in the docs. Like that's been in the docs for a year. You know, it was one paragraph because it was like, you're working on so much stuff and you don't have time to sit down and write a paper on everything like that. But it was also, if anybody spent time to think about it, and they would stumble on the same thing. So as far as now, I'm excited that people are excited about it. And every now and then, like I'll see some book like, ChatGPT for writers. I'll roll my eyes like, oh, let me just pick it. I'm looking at it like, oh, wow, there's good stuff in here. There's like, I'll find some place. There are people actually doing really good stuff. A lot of BS, a lot of hype artists, a lot of people that like, you know, got broke from crypto and are looking for the next thing to sort of catch on to, you know, are waiting for those NFTs to, you know, get their value back. But there are a lot of really creative. So I try not to be too dismissive because sometimes you find stuff, but I do get frustrated, I'll be honest, with a lot of academic papers, a lot of that, because there's a lot of, like, in the academic world, everybody's out there to go put out, you know, a paper on ChatGPT or whatever like this, which is good, but you find out that sometimes their level of prompting is really not good. And I've seen a number of, it can't do this, can't do this. Like, why did you write it like that? Like, that's not even, you know, like, that's not a thing, you know? I did a thing about, there was the thing came out about the reversal curse, which you're claiming that these models can't do, like, reverse generalizations. Looked at the paper, and they didn't, one, they admitted they can, models can do, if you put it in context, the idea of reversal curse means I can say, Logan's mom, his name is Kathy, you know, a bunch of times. But if I go ask, who is Kathy's son or whatever, like, it won't, we're generalized from one to the other. That's the theory, at least. But in the paper, they admitted that if you put that information in context, like in the prompt, it will be able to do it, which to me is like, well, clearly there's a mechanism in the transformers to do this. And then I looked at how they were training the model, and this was a tricky thing that's not really well documented, was because of the new way you train models is you would do in your message things, you can do a system message, you can do an assistant message, and a user message, right? They were putting the thing they wanted to generalize to in the user and the answer in the assistant message, and that's not a good way to train a model, because these models, to reduce hallucination, try not to take too much influence from the user message. What you do is you put everything inside of the assistant message and do that. And so I just took their data, did that one change, or just put in the assistant message and showed, yeah, they can generalize. So you do see, I guess my point is, it's everybody. Everybody's trying to get into AI. It can be researchers, everybody, and they're in a rush to sort of say, hey, look at me. And I look at my blog post. I was doing that. I'm like, hey, look what I got it to do. Look what I got it to do. So who am I to cast blame?
I guess off of that, you know, with all the AI buzz and all these organizations that are coming to fruition now, I guess I'm always curious to hear from individuals we have on the podcast, you know, what their personal tech stack looks like, what tools outside of just Gemini potentially or ChatGPT, you know, curious from a work standpoint, but also just, you know, from an individual standpoint personally, what you kind of use or play around with.
Well, you know, AI Studio is a really good environment to play around with models too. So let me make that very clear. Very excited to see that Logan gets to be working with that. Which is actually generally cool. It's neat to see the evolution of these things, of like what would be, as a guy that started writing his own tools because I got frustrated by what the lack of tool development, or like the OpenAI playground, which was like, you know, like, come on, let's make this better. Which has gotten way better now. Amazing what we can do when you hire researchers. And like I said, AI Studio is really good. So as far as playing around with stuff or working, Cursor has been my go-to IDE. I have several Cursor windows open right now. And I like is that you can switch around. Like, I don't know if you saw the update. You can now use Gemini Flash in there. It's got a lot of great capability. GPT-4.0, which I love. I was using Claude 3 a lot for coding because Claude 3 was really, really good at coding. And then I would sometimes spend like $40 a day in tokens. Tells you, you know, either how bad of a coder I am or how much I code. And then I've been using GPT-4.0 for that. But there's a lot of other models there too. And so like, I'm going to start, I'm not just saying this with Logan's here, but I'm curious because I got a couple projects where I want to start using Gemini Flash for, because I think it's a great offering. So my tech stack for that generally tends to be for my IDEs, Cursor. I have the ChatGPT app on my Mac. I use that. I hit Option Spacebar. When I write as a writer, as a novelist, I use Scrivener, which is just a writing thing. And the frustrating thing is there's no plugins for it. So what I've done is I've gone into Automator and I've added things like if I highlight text, I can use my mouse and then send it to an AI model to say, hey, can you summarize this? You know, can you give me, you know, can you do a little bit of research? Because I might be in the middle of writing a book and I don't want to have to go look something up. So I'll just highlight something and then say, you know, give me some background on it. I'm like, well, the thing about MK Ultra is this. So I've been using Automator tasks, building tools. So my last book, my wrists were starting to hurt because between when I'm not writing, I'm coding. So that's a lot of wrist fatigue. And I'd flirted with dictation apps forever and even built one years ago. I built a thing called Story Voice. This is pre-GPT-3, et cetera. And I had to like program and I had to write all these grammatical rules for how to like add punctuation and stuff to sentences, which, you know, is time I'm never going to get back. So I don't try to think about how much time I spent trying to programmatically add these things in. For this latest book, I was in a bit of a bind and I wanted to use dictation, but there's just the problem with, I'll take you on a side jag here, which is probably maybe relevant to, you know, 2% of your audience, but when you want to record a book, or if you want to try to do dictation, you know, the fantasy in my head was like, I'm just going to click record and just start generating my book like it's an audiobook just coming out of my mouth. That's not what happens. Not for me. Because, you know, I click record and I'm like, the guy looked at the recorder in his hand and didn't know what to say next. And the key that I learned from Kevin Anderson, Kevin J. Anderson, he's the guy that co-wrote the Dune sequels with Brian Herbert. Kevin's notorious person for using dictation is you click record when you have something to say, then you stop. Record, stop, record, stop. I know, amazing, incredible. You know, took me this many years to figure that out. Point is, knowing that, knowing this, I was very easy for me to put together a tool where I could just record and then transcribe my voice. For transcription, I was using DeepGram because they have a very fast, cheap model. And then Grok, G-R-O-Q, Grok Cloud, which does their LPUs. They actually just added Whisper Large that does like 170x speedup. I haven't tried that yet, but I was using a transcription model to transcribe my text, then sending it to a very simple LLM and saying, hey, just here, the app I made would know which character was speaking, then say add the dialogue tag for that. So long story short, I made a little tool for me to dictation improved. I use, yeah, grok.com, groq.com. I use their stuff a lot. That's super fast. Like they've got their Llama 3 8 billion parameter model, 1,200 tokens per second. 1,200 tokens per second, right? So I'm very much into the agentic way of doing things where I will take a couple tiny models and say, I want you to do a task. You evaluate the task. You go do this to the task and then get the output. And, you know, I can get way faster than using a much larger model. I can get really good results out of that. So it's kind of an exciting frontier. So that's been kind of my tech stack. So DeepGram, Grok,
I guess Cursor. A quick question off that too. Do you, I mean, obviously the ChatGPT store came to fruition, right? Now you have all these different, you know, parameters that are out there that are supposed to be a little bit more refined. And I know there's a whole, you know, writing content section as well. Do you use any of the GPTs or do you just usually use the normal interface?
I have my own that I developed with my wife, and in my very biased opinion is the best tool for writing there is. Just because coming in from somebody who is a professional writer who has to produce hundreds of thousands of words per year on contract for the publisher and also prompt engineering and worked on the models and understands what they're good and what they're not at. So, you know, I've built, you know, there. I think there are probably some really good tools there. I think it's a good starting point. You know, the problem is that I saw this early on with like GPT-3 where, you know, people would say, oh, I'm using it to help give me advice on writing. And it was literally like a fortune cookie. It was literally like, you do this. And it wasn't really evaluating their writing, but it was giving them feedback. It was giving them some sort of feedback. I had my agent call me an hour ago to say she, you know, read my latest book and it sucks. She'll tell me. So I get, you know, expert feedback, you know, from somebody who repped Hunter S. Thompson. So I get really good feedback. Sometimes I don't want it. And so I see the value of that, of having something tell you that. I think these models have gotten better, but they're not good. You give it a 3,000 word essay, it's going to try to say something to please you, you know, and it's just, they just can't at this point without, I say can't by themselves, they can't. There are ways that you can deconstruct the text, create, you know, paragraph by paragraph summarizations and things you can do with a lot of prompting. You can build a tool to do it, but natively they're not so good.
There's been a bunch of speculation about whether or not AI has sort of hit the wall of continued improvement, mostly because, you know, the narrative of GPT-4 finished training summer of 2022. A lot of recent models are sort of just eclipsing or maybe not eclipsing, depending on some of the benchmarks. The original GPT-4 model. What's your sense of where we're heading? Have we hit the wall? Is there still a lot of room to grow as far as the capability of these models go?
I don't think we're anywhere near a wall. And again, we're going to make predictions about the future, but in a lot of the people saying we hit the wall are people every year who say we hit the wall. And, you know, some very prominent people who said we would never get to where we are were like, we've hit the wall. I'm like, you've been wrong every time. Why would you be right now? So a way to think about this is training a GPT-1, super easy. You know, you can do that over a weekend, whatever. You just have to know, go take the Google paper and transformers and then say, I'm going to go take this corpus of Amazon reviews and apply it to that. I want to do like next word prediction, whatever, sentiment analysis, really do next word prediction. Fine. GPT-2 takes a bit more compute, but you know, now, you know, Carpathy has courses on how to train your own GPT-2 in a weekend, you know, and also the cost of compute since GPT-2 has gone down considerably and there's way more GPUs to do it. So that's another factor too, is I could try and travel back in time with that course to you back in 2019 and be useful, but a lot of the tools and stuff weren't there. GPT-3 took a lot longer, took longer to create because it was a substantially bigger model. The time from GPT-3 to GPT-4, okay, people go, oh, it was, well, they go, oh, well, that was 2 years ago. Cool. What was the time frame from GPT-3 to GPT-4? GPT-3 was, you know, the version was ready late 2019, started showing it to early people, you know, early 2020, myself included, didn't get released till June, but had been around. And GPT-4, which came out in, would have finished training in 2022, but also had to go through safety testing, all this stuff. So there was a 2 year gap, and it's not like these things get faster because they're bigger. If you're using, the easiest way to think about this is the OpenAI approach is to use 10x the compute on the next model, right? So if you want to go from GPT-1, use 10x the compute, GPT-2 to 3 was 10x the compute, GPT-3 to GPT-4 is 10x the compute. What does that mean? Well, it can mean I can have, you know, I can have 100,000 computers working for a month to go train this model, or I could have 50,000 computers working for 2 months to train this model, okay? Or I can have 25,000 computers working for whatever, you know, thing of that time. And that's the thing you have to think about is, you measure compute, there's the total amount of compute you have training, there's the amount of time you have compute, and then you get into the tokens, et cetera. So it would have been amazing if they were able to come out with a GPT-5 at a faster rate than they came out with a GPT-3, but that wouldn't make any sense as far as that. There's also the amount of time that takes to do safety training, you know, as far as do safety evaluations, et cetera. So if we've had a wall, there's no reason to know from anything we've seen right now because things take long. I use the example of, I did a Twitter post about this where I talked about, you know, the guy that made Breakout, the original Pong, the original Pong game, the Pong video game, took him 2 months. One guy took him 2 months. Grand Theft Auto 6 has been under development, well, been under development for like 5 years by the time that it comes out. Did we hit a video game wall? Did we? Well, no, of course not. These things are way more complex. We get into people who kind of don't really, and I don't want to say this mean, but like people who aren't really into it will get fixated on like, well, we run out of tokens on the internet or whatever. And it's like, well, one, and we talked about this before, I can take that, you know, I can take that same text, you know, I could take all of the available tokens and say common crawl, and I could go back and feed it to a model and say, hey, I want you to write a summary of everything here. I want you to categorize each token as whether or not this is a factual statement or statement of opinion or something else from person. Not even counting getting the image tokens and video and all these other things. So I can take that existing data and I can augment it and create way more tokens that a more complex model could pick up on than the synthetic data and then that. I had a, like when we were, when I had to handle the launch of like GPT-4 as far as like, you know, creating a launch page of video and crumbling up these examples to show what it could do. And it was frustrating because ChatGPT had come out and they kept doing these weekly updates to 3.5. And every time they did an update to 3.5, it got better. And my examples of showing, well, GPT-4 can do this, 3.5 could. Like, oh, wait, 3.5 can do that now? Oh, now I got to figure out something, you know, to show that, you know, 4 can do. And so we could just see how you can see, you could go back and take an existing thing and find so much improvement for there. So, no, I don't think we fit a wall. Example I use, the Wright brothers, they built the Wright Flyer. It took them like 7 months. It took an SR-71 jet 7 years to get developed. You know, like that's, complex things are more complex.
Andrew, how do you think generative AI context will impact the publishing industry, but also more so kind of the ownership rights for those texts, for those publications? You know, like I said, I think a lot of folks are using, you know, when you have a large language model and can output text very quickly, using obviously to their advantage to build some of these publications. But, you know, I think that also kind of on the flip side, you have these individuals who aren't using these models, you know, still doing the old school publications and, you know, maybe might have some envy.
Yeah. So think about this. You know, you get a paper that comes out like an archive, like somebody writes a new paper on, you know, some new development. Okay. I'm going to want to consume that in a couple ways, aside from reading the paper. One is I'm going to really love an AI summary that just distills that paper down to understanding what I need and explains the stuff that I need explained to me, because maybe some of it's beyond me. Cannot tell you how often I had to use working at OpenAI, how often I had to use GPT-4 and stuff to explain stuff to me. So people would be, I'd be on a Slack and like, dot, dot, dot. I'm like, cool. What the hell does this mean? You know, my favorite thing was, I never worked at a big company and worked at any company before. And somebody talked to me about, well, figure out who your DRI is going to be. I didn't know what a DRI was. And I Googled DRI and it was a band called Dirty Rotten Imbeciles. And I'm like, man, they're pretty harsh here. Like, who's going to be the dirty rotten imbecile for this? Directly responsible individual, as I found out later on. But anyhow, if you have that paper that comes through there, one, I might just want a really short summation of it so I can get it in my head and understand it. Then I might want, you know, I might want Logan's take on it. You know, I might want Logan to tell me, in my experience, this is what I've thought about this. This is what it means from, you know, some a practical point of view, a developer or somebody who's looking at new, how does it affect new companies that might be doing this? And then I might want, you know, a really, you know, really nerdy, wonky sort of analysis. And Google just released a thing, right? Didn't they, Logan, about like two, they had like a paper, they take a paper and have two AIs discuss the paper back and forth. And so there's a lot of different ways in which you can evaluate information. So when it comes to things about the world, sometimes I want the facts, sometimes I want the opinions. And I will watch Google videos to watch, I want to see what how is this person dissing on Madam Web? You know, how is this person doing this? And then I want that. So there's a place for a lot of different kinds of, you know, text information in the world. Sometimes we want facts, sometimes we want opinions, sometimes we want commentary, sometimes we just want to watch a fight breakout. As a writer, I think that a lot of content people are going to consume will be AI generated. I think that a lot of people, you know, a 5-year-old doesn't care, you know, who's writing their TV show. They don't even think that there's a concept of the writer. They're watching characters on screen. You know, as you get older and you watch this, where I have friends that like movies, but they'll attribute every line of dialogue in the movie to the director, not realizing that a writer wrote that director, because they don't, the concept of agency, there being multiple people, isn't a thing that really registers with most of us. So I would say that we're going to see a lot of different kinds of content. We're going to be using a lot of generative content for entertainment, for reading, for writing. As far as it for publishing stuff right now, it can do news articles. It can do that kind of stuff. I've worked with media companies and showed them that it was much better than they realized, which was concerning to them, but still can't do other things. And I like Stephen King books because Stephen King wrote them. You know, AI Stephen King, I might read an AI Stephen King book if people say it's great, but I'm still going to want to read a thing by Stephen King. So I guess I don't know if that's quite a direct answer what you're asking, Nolan, but I think there's a place for a lot of these different kinds of, you know, content.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I think I've seen the thread come up a bunch about, like, you know, the value of being human goes up so significantly in a world where AI and the cost of intelligence is so low. It's like face-to-face interaction, doing stuff in real life, like all of it ends up like becoming like an even more premium experience than it already is, which I'm actually personally really excited about.
Yeah, I have an article in this month's, the June edition of Reason Magazine, where I talk about how AI will lead to a 0% unemployment and the idea that in a really high growth economy, and this is my crit towards my peers in AI and my betters, is we can imagine a future where AI replace all the tasks that we have right now, right? And you can say like, oh, I can have an AI, you know, gardener, I can have an AI doctor, I can have this, like, yes. And they go, like, well, what will people do? That's like a bunch of farmers, you know, looking, people who pulled, you know, roots out of the ground, looking at a plow going, what are we going to do if the plow does all the plowing? We turned out okay. We found other things to do. And that's the same thing. Like, it's not like innovation stops or the economy doesn't grow. All of a sudden, you create new opportunities, things to do that. You know, I've seen AI researchers I respect and love go like, well, one day an AI will do my job and what'll I do? That's like the people at Bletchley Park trying to solve the Enigma machine going, well, if we get a lot of mechanical calculators, who's going to need a mathematician? Well, guess what? There are way more mathematicians now than there were before, because you then become managing the problem becomes a thing. It's not just solving the problem, managing the problem. As Logan said, understanding why this problem is more important than another problem. Sometimes that's not just because of something you can figure out in a spreadsheet. That is what's going to happen. We're going to have more scientists, more many of these things. You're going to be working with a bunch of AIs to help you do a task, and then you're going to sit down with a bunch of humans and some AIs, and you're going to discuss what's going to be, you know, a value, whatever. the value of being a human is going to go up. Like the value of having a human help you is going to go up, even when the AIs are smarter than us, even when the AIs are stronger than us. Because that's the other factor. There will never be enough computers. There'll never be enough robots. We could have robot assembly plants producing robots night and day. And if you can tell me, oh, we'll fix everything wrong in the world in 5 years, well, guess what? Then we get to build a new world on top of it and keep building and keep building. So that's my take.
Twitter, I guess with some of the time we have left too, would love to dive into your endeavor now, which is interdimensional AI, you know, kind of for the folks listening, what it is, why you started, some of the challenges that it's looking to, you know, kind of combat. I would love to give the audience some insight into that.
I'm working on a thing, and I hate to use the word stealth because it means it sounds like, oh, I'm working on something so cool I can't tell you about. And if there's another word, and I am the guy, I did build a stealth suit for Swimming with the Great White Shark. So, you know, there I am, living hypocrite right in front of you everybody. I will tell you, like, I launched a consultancy, which was just to help people adapt to AI and do that and do a lot of, like, half my time talking to venture capitalists, trying to explain how this stuff works and my take on this. Other half talking to companies, trying to build whatever. That's sort of the part. The area I'm very interested in, and I hopefully will be able to show something soon, is we understand a lot right now about, an ad, a text ad, like what somebody's going to click on, what they're not. You look at their profile, understand that. If you have a video feed like TikTok, you understand a lot about what kind of videos to show somebody, you know, and sometimes aren't the best, you know, examples of stuff for us to watch. If you have a news feed or run sort of news feed, we understand a lot like what engages people, whatever. We have a tremendous amount of data on a lot of things in the world. Tesla has incredible self-driving data, right? They have all this data from the billions of miles of camera footage, et cetera, of roads. They have that data. And Apple Watch has all this fitness data. Tonal, I have a Tonal gym. I don't know if you've seen that. Like it's amazing, you know, like these are robot gym. And that's got a ton of data on like, you know, strength training, whatever like this. When it comes to education and understanding how we learn, we have very little data. Now, there's some data we could parse out. You know, if you gave me some time with, you know, some of the YouTube algorithms to look through at people's attention spans, where they drop off, doing the comparisons to what was said on screen, visuals, whatever, I could do that. But there's not a lot. Learning technology, we talk about learning tech or ed tech. There are a lot of neat little ideas and some interesting things, but there's just not a really good body of knowledge or resource as far as like understanding really the most efficient ways to communicate or teach to people. And nothing we can point to and says, yes, this gets better every year. And that's what I've been working on, is basically how do you apply AI, which is now incredibly capable in certain areas, with the ability to sort of figure out how you can improve the way in which we learn.
Andrew, you owe us a demo as soon as you have something ready to share. Yeah. So you're on the hook for it. But the closing question that Nolan and I would love to end with is, given that we're 6 months into the year, I'm curious if you have any thoughts on, you know, something that you really hope happens in the AI ecosystem before the end of 2024, and something that you really hope potentially doesn't happen.
I have been encouraged by the proliferation of open source models and the lowering of cost on access to these things. You know, OpenAI has GPT-4o available as a free tier. Google is putting this into places. Microsoft's trying to make these things available. We have really, really good capable, I'm a fan of the Llama 3 8B model. It's a tiny little model, but it's like really capable for a lot of little tasks. And that's an encouraging thing because, you know, I was ready to leave OpenAI about a year in because my concern was, how are people who don't have credit cards going to get access to AI? Like, how is the rest of the world going to be able to make use of these things? They saw how powerful they can be as a tutor for helping all sorts of things. And I had a conversation with Sam Altman about this. And Sam's like, you know, this is important to him. He's this thing we're working on, you know, stick around, see what happens. And sure enough, that's what happened. You know, ChatGPT, you know, they opened up, they created, you know, a great, you know, free tier, all this. And that was the people that run that, Nick Turley, others, conversations with them, very much like, how do you create a system where you can get as many people using this for free as possible? OpenAI launched an EDU thing. Google, of course, is doing, you know, tremendous efforts in there. And I think that AI as a general, the industry cares very much about providing access, and people can apply all sorts of sinister intentions they want to it. But the only difference between a company or a nonprofit or a church or whatever is literally a checkbox that you fill out. You know, you get the same kind of people coming to this with the same kind of ambitions, and you can be motivated and have different sort of things that you're optimized for your efficiencies for. But after a certain point, you know, you do the things you want. So I think that there is a very healthy attitude towards making these things widely available. So this year, I feel like we're going to see more of that, more of these things being out there. Khan Academy's got Khanmigo, their tutor they're doing, and I think we're going to see a lot. So I'm encouraged this year, I think, is going to be really big, impactful for education. We're going to see a lot of great education tools available to everybody, you know, and that's not, and I think about this is that, you know, many of our friends, whatever, if they want to hire a tutor for the kid, that they don't think twice about it. But, you know, if you're growing up in, you know, Malaysia, you know, if you're somewhere in the global South or whatever, that is a luxury you can't afford. And making those systems available and good systems available to, you know, young people improves the quality of life for all of us. So it's worthwhile. So I see that being this year a thing that we're going to see a lot more positive. You know, my concern is I'm less worried about like the existential risks of AI than I was, you know, a couple years ago. The more I got to understand these and the rate at which they were developing, the less concerned I became about that, because I understand that I got away from the naive understanding that you just flip a switch and all of a sudden, you know, you've got a genie that pops out of the bottle. It's like, aha, I got out. And it's more incremental systems that build up over time. And you create an ecosystem of AIs and, you know, and there's also economic things like this. I think a lot of people who project AI extinction are using very, they imagine AI as like Hannibal Lecter. You know, they imagine this, they're anthropomorphizing these things in ways that just doesn't make sense to me. And even if you say, you know, something that wants to maximize efficiency or whatever, I can show you the economic and biological arguments why that's not true. Like, we are three people here talking on our microphones, filled with a gut biome of, you know, bacteria inside of our stomachs functioning quite well. I live in the middle of nature. I live around these things. It's not efficient for one system to try to completely annihilate everything else. And, you know, we're like, oh, but look at man. Like, well, yeah, we criticize ourselves for structure and environment. I think a smarter system would say no. So I don't worry about that as much anymore. I worry about, you know, misuse, things like this, deep fakes. My biggest concern right now is the ability for these systems to mimic stuff. If I got a call from Logan and he said, hey, I'm in a Mexican jail, I need you to send money, I'd be like, well, one, of course, I knew this was going to happen. I don't think I'd hesitate. I think I would fall for that. I think I would absolutely fall for those kinds of, you know, things. And as smart as I like to think I am, I could be an idiot. That concerns me. And I think we need to think more about that. How do we build trusted forms of communication? You know, how do we authenticate that we know the person on the other end is who they say they are, at least they're using their device, et cetera. So I think that's going to be a very, very big area, very important area, is understand. Let's get past the fact that there's going to be tons of deepfakes and stuff. Forget about the election interference. That I don't worry about that. I worry about somebody calling up my mom, you know, and defrauding her money other than me, because that's my job.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And I think there's a large portion of society who is not yet aware that the technology is actually capable of doing these things. And like, it's a huge, like large societal scale education problem as well, to like keep people independent of the technology piece of it, of just like making people aware that this is even possible.
Yeah. Jeffrey Hinton was in the news because he said what we need to do is flood the world with a bunch of deep fakes so people understand their fakes. I said the problem is like the immune system. Well, what you then get is organ rejection, is then you won't accept real information. And so I saw that making it around. I could be like, oh, it's like the immune system. It's like, yeah, but the opposite of that is you end up with the ability where your body won't accept any new thing, rejects everything. And so that's the problem. Is it like, I don't think there's an easy solution to it. But by talking about it here, we're doing our part.
Well, Andrew, thank you very, very much. I think that was a phenomenal conversation. Hopefully all of our listeners thought the same, but very insightful. Again, love to kind of get your perspective, especially kind of after understanding how you got to the point where you are now. I think obviously a lot of cool things go into it. So again, thank you very much.
Yeah, 100%.